your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are grass make dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We've got a lot to cover this week. I spent a little time driving up from Oklahoma to Missouri, and we ran into a problem there between Oklahoma and Wellington, Kansas. They closed down part of the Interstate 35, which is the Kansas Turnpike also. So that was quite an experience. It took over an hour to get around that detour. Anyway, I'm back in Austin now, and I'm going to give you some commentary on some news coming out of Congress and other places. We've got Senator Cornyn questioning Attorney General Barr about why the Obama administration did not inform the Trump campaign about possible Russian interference with the elections. So here we go now. Listen carefully.
General Barr, the chairman has pointed out that after the Hillary Clinton email investigation, there were a number at Mr. Comey's press conference. I think it was July the 5th, roughly 2016. There were a number of prominent Democratic members of the Senate who said that Comey should resign or be fired. I believe you said that you've concluded as a matter of law that the president, as the head of the executive branch of government, has the right to fire executive branch employees. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
That's right.
In this case, the president was relying, at least in part, on a recommendation by the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, arising out of Rod Rosenstein's critique of Mr. Comey's conduct in holding that press conference, releasing derogatory information about Secretary Clinton, but then announcing that no reasonable prosecutor would bring charges against her. Is that right?
That's right.
You started your career, I believe, in the intelligence community, and then moved on, of course, to the Department of Justice. And thank you for agreeing to serve again as Attorney General and help restore the department's reputation as an impartial arbiter of the law and not as a political arm of any administration. I think that's very, very important that you and Director Wray continue your efforts in that regard, and I'm grateful to you for that. But I do believe that we need to ask the question, why didn't the Obama administration do more as early as 2014 in investigating Russian efforts to prepare to undermine and sow dissension in the 2016 election? Mr. Mueller's report does document that the Russian government, through the intelligence, through their intelligence agencies and their internet research, or IRA, I think it's called, began as early as 2014, began their efforts to do so, and we know they met with some success. Is it any surprise to you, based on your experience, that the Russians would try to do everything they can to sow dissension in American political life, including in our elections?
No, not at all. I mean, I think the internet creates a lot more opportunities to have that kind of covert effect on American body politics. So it's getting more and more dangerous. But the Russians have been at this for a long time in various different ways. But the point you made about Bob Mueller's efforts on IRA, that's one of the things that struck me about the report. I think it's very impressive work that they did in moving quickly to get into the IRA and also the GRU folks. And I was thinking to myself, if that had been done in 2000, you know, starting in the beginning of 2016, we would have been a lot further along.
For example, we've heard a lot about the Steele dossier. Mr. Steele, of course, is a former British intelligence officer hired by to do opposition research by the Hillary Clinton campaign on her political adversaries, including President Trump or candidate Trump at that time. How do we know that the Steele dossier is not itself evidence of Russian disinformation campaign, knowing what we know now that basically the allegations made therein were secondhand, hearsay, or unverified? Can we state with confidence that the Steele dossier was not part of the Russian disinformation campaign?
No, I can't state that with confidence, and that is one of the areas that I'm reviewing. I'm concerned about it, and I don't think it's entirely speculative.
Well, we know that from published reports that the head of the CIA, Mr. Brennan, went to President Obama and brought his concerns about initial indications of Russian involvement in the campaign as early as the late July 2016. And instead of doing more during the Obama administration to look into that and disrupt and deter Russian activities that threatened the validity and integrity of our campaign in 2016, it appears to me that the Obama administration, Justice Department, and FBI decided to place their bets on Hillary Clinton and focus their efforts on investigating the Trump campaign. But as you have pointed out, thanks to the special counsel, we now have confidence that no Americans colluded with the Russians in their effort to undermine the American people. We now need to know, and I'm glad to hear what you are telling us about your inquiries and your research and your investigation. We now need to know what steps the Obama FBI, Department of Justice, and intelligence community, what steps they took to undermine the political process and put a thumb on the scale in favor of one political candidate over the other, and that would be before and after the 2016 election. What's a defensive briefing that in a counterintelligence investigation?
Well, you could have different kinds of defensive briefings. If you learn that somebody is being targeted by a hostile intelligence service, then one form of defensive briefing is to go and to alert that person to the risks.
I think Attorney General Lynch has said it is routine in counterintelligence investigations. Would you agree with her?
Yes.
Do you know whether a defensive briefing was ever given to the Trump campaign by the FBI based on their counterintelligence investigation? Did they ever tell the president before he was January 2017 what the Russians were trying to do and advise him to tell people affiliated with this campaign to be on their guard and be vigilant about Russian efforts to undermine public confidence in the election?
My understanding is that didn't happen.
That would be that failure to provide a defensive briefing to the Trump campaign, that would be an extraordinary or notable failure. Would you agree?
I think under these circumstances, it's one of the things that I can't fathom why it did not happen. If you're concerned about interference in the election and you have, you know, substantial people involved in the campaign who were former U.S. attorneys, you had three former U.S. attorneys there in the campaign, I don't understand why the Bureau would not have gone and given a defensive briefing.
Our next clip coming up is Senator Mazie Hirono out of Hawaii questioning Attorney General Barr. What she does on this, the first half of this, is just accusations and assertions with no actual proof. Just, and it's all a political stunt on her part. And then she does ask a few questions, and then she ignores, you know, Attorney General Barr's, you know what I mean. She just lambastes and tries to run over him. But listen to this. This is how politically this particular person has become, you know. Here we go now.
Mr. Barr, now the American people know that you are no different from Rudy Giuliani or Kellyanne Conway or any of the other people who sacrificed their once decent reputation for the grifter and liar who sits in the Oval Office. You once turned down a job offer from Donald Trump to represent him as his private attorney. At your confirmation hearing, you told Senator Feinstein that, quote, the job of attorney general is not the same as representing, end quote, the president. So you know the difference, but you've chosen to be the president's lawyer and side with him over the interests of the American people. To start with, you should never have been involved in supervising the Robert Mueller investigation. You wrote a 19-page unsolicited memo, which you admit was not based on any facts, attacking the premise of half of the investigation. And you also should have insisted that Deputy Attorney General Rob Rosenstein recuse himself. He wasn't just a witness to some of the president's obstructive behavior. We now know he was in frequent personal contact with the president, a subject of the investigation. You should have left it to career officials. Then, once the report was delivered by the special counsel, you delayed its release for more than 2 weeks. You let the president's personal lawyers look at it before you even deigned to let Congress or the public see it. During the time you substituted your own political judgment for the special counsel's legal conclusions in a four-page letter to Congress. And now we know, thanks to a free press, that Mr. Mueller wrote you a letter objecting to your so-called summary. When you called Mueller to discuss his letter, the reports are that he thought your summary was giving the press, Congress, and the public a misleading impression of his work. He asked you to release the report summaries to correct the misimpression you created, but you refused. When you finally did decide to release the report over a congressional recess and on the eve of two major religious holidays, you called a press conference to once again try to clear Donald Trump before anyone had a chance to read the special counsel's report and come to their own conclusions. But when we read the report, we knew Robert Mueller's concerns were valid, and that your version of events was false. You used every advantage of your office to create the impression that the president was cleared of misconduct. You selectively quoted fragments from the special counsel's report, taking some of the most important statements out of context and ignoring the rest. You put the power and authority of the Office of the Attorney General and the Department of Justice behind a public relations effort to help Donald Trump protect himself. Finally, you lied to Congress. You told Representative Charlie Crist that you didn't know what objections Mueller's team might have to your March 24th so-called summary. You told Senator Chris Van Hollen that you didn't know if Bob Mueller supported your conclusions. But you knew. You lied. And now we know. A lot of respected nonpartisan legal experts and elected officials were surprised by your efforts to protect the president. But I wasn't surprised. You did exactly what I thought you'd do. It's why I voted against your confirmation. I expected you would try to protect the president, and indeed you did. In 1989, this isn't something you hadn't done before. In 1989, when you refused to show Congress an OLC opinion that led to the arrest of Manuel Noriega. In 1992, when you recommended pardons for the subjects of the Iran-Contra scandal. And last year, when you wrote the 19-page memo telling Donald Trump, as president, can't be guilty of obstruction of justice and then didn't recuse yourself from the matter. From the beginning, you were addressing an audience of one, that person being Donald Trump. That's why, before the bombshell news of yesterday evening, 11 of my Senate colleagues and I called on the Department of Justice Inspector General and Office of Professional Responsibility to investigate the way you have handled the Mueller report. I wanted them to determine whether your actions complied with the department's policies and practices and whether you have demonstrated sufficient impartiality to continue to oversee the 14 other criminal matters that the special counsel referred to in other parts to other parts of the Department of Justice. But now, we know more about your deep involvement in trying to cover up for Donald Trump. Being Attorney General of the United States is a sacred trust. You have betrayed that trust. America deserves better. You should resign. I have some questions for you. Is the White House exerting any influence on your decision whether to allow Special Counsel Mueller to testify in Congress and when?
No.
Now, you've been clear today that you don't think that any of the 10 episodes of possible obstruction that the Special Counsel outlined is a crime. I disagree. But you seem to think that if it's not a crime, then there's no problem. Nothing to see here, nothing to worry about. So, with apologies to Adam Schiff, do you think all of the things that President Trump did are okay? Are they what the President of the United States should be doing? For example, do you think it's okay for a president to fire an FBI director to stop him from investigating links between his campaign and Russia? It may not be a crime, but do you think it's okay?
Well, I think the report is clear that...
No, I'm not talking about the report its analysis of whether a crime occurred. I'm asking you.
I don't think this is a crime,
but do you think it's okay for the president to do what he did, to fire the special counsel to keep them from investigating?
I do think it's okay to do what he did, and I don't think the evidence supports the proposition.
So I guess you think it's okay.
To stop the investigation.
Do you think it's okay for a president to ask his White House counsel to lie?
Well, I'm willing to talk about what's criminal.
But no, but we've already acknowledged that you think it was not a crime. I'm just asking whether you think it's okay. Even if it's not a crime, do you think it's okay for the president to ask his White House counsel to lie?
Which
Look, if you're just going to go back to whether
which
or not
event
it's a crime,
you
you're telling
about?
Me that
which
it's okay. Let me ask you the last question that I have in 17 seconds. Do you think it's okay for a president to offer pardons to people who don't testify against him, to threaten the family of someone who does? Is that okay?
When did he offer a pardon to someone?
I think you know what I'm talking about. Please.
What do you mean?
Please, Mr. Attorney General, you know, give us some credit for knowing what the hell is going on around here with you.
Not really. To this line of questioning.
So,
listen, you've slandered this man.
Yeah, what I sort of want to know is how do we get to this point? Yeah,
I do not think that
how
I'm
do we get
slandering
to the point
anyone.
All I can say,
Mr. Chairman, I am done. Thank you very much.
And you slandered this man from top to bottom. So if you want more of this, you're not going to get it. If you want to ask him questions, you can't.
Next, we have the other side. In the form of Devin Nunes, is to send a letter to the FBI, and here's where they're really trying to uncover what went on against Trump, where they spied on him and everything else. But here Devin Nunes speaking about sending this letter. Here we go now.
Congressman Devin Nunes, ranking member of the House Intel Committee, and we want to zero in on the letter that you sent late Friday, Congressman, to the heads of the FBI, the DOJ, as well as the NSA and the CIA. Why did you write this letter?
Well, we're trying to get to the bottom of Mifsud. So as we talked about it in the last segment, this guy originates the investigation. We know that the Mueller team wrote this Mueller dossier. They used a lot of these news stories that, in fact, sometimes were generated by leaks from the FBI. Now, I don't think the American people expect 20 DOJ lawyers and 40 FBI agents to write a 450-page report that's built off of news stories that, in many cases, they generated. Why I particularly have a problem with this is with one of the stories is because they pick a news story and then they cherry pick from it. So they use it partly to describe where Mifsud worked, but then they fail to say in that same story that they have given support to by using it in the Mueller dossier, they cherry pick it and they don't use that Mifsud was described as a Western intelligence asset. Now, Maria, anybody who's out there, all they have to do is get on the World Wide Web. And if you type in Joseph Mifsud, Link Campus, which is where he worked, you will see, you will find, you don't even have to be able to read, okay? You'll find pictures of him with many foreign dignitaries, foreign leaders. You'll see that the Link Campus had the FBI was on the Link Campus doing training nearly all the time, nearly every year. So how is it that we spend $30+ million on this as taxpayers?
Yeah.
And they can't even tell us who Joseph Mifsud is. So that's, we're getting to the bottom of this. So we believe he has ties to the State Department. The State Department, actually our State Department, had him in the United States Capitol in 2017. Joseph Mifsud. This is, and remember, why is Mifsud so important? Because the Mueller dossier team, they essentially make this guy out to be a Russian asset under the control of Putin, said that he says he has ties to these Russians. You know, sound familiar? So, you know, this is the origination of this investigation. And it seems like Mifsud has an awful lot of ties to U.S., British, and Italian intelligence services.
Do you believe that the FBI had all of these sources out to entrap people from the Trump campaign so that they could claim that there was a conspiracy, that Donald Trump was colluding with the Russians? But in fact, they put all of these sources all across the world to get to members of the Trump campaign, like they reached out to Papadopoulos.
Well, remember what I said on your show last year?
Yep.
I think I actually said, I think I said it first on your show, as I recall. I said, I'm not worried about whether or not they were spying on the Trump campaign. That is fact. What I want to know is how many spies with an S were involved in this. And I mean, and this is why we have to get to the bottom of this. Why all this information needs to come out.
Let me ask you this. Go ahead.
Yes.
Finish your thought, Congressman.
Well, on Mifsud. So in the letter, we also point out there's a lot of talk about how Papadopoulos, who was just on earlier, he caused the FBI and the Mueller team problems because he didn't tell them about the relationship with Mifsud and how Mifsud had offered emails. Now, this is in 2017. Okay, this is in the Mueller dossier. So this is all about in 2017. How Papadopoulos harms their investigation.
Yeah.
Right? Well, how is it then that the FBI, or supposedly the FBI or other assets, know to continually ask Papadopoulos about emails, about Clinton emails in 2016?
Right. Nobody knew it except
none of that
and Papadopoulos. So how did the FBI know if
Mifsud
wasn't an asset of the FBI? Let me ask you this. All of this spying going on early in 16, watching Papadopoulos, knowing that he was reaching out to Lewandowski, this London center reaching out to him to go work there, there wasn't a warrant. The FISA warrant to spy on an American citizen like they did with Carter Page didn't happen until October later that year. So was this illicit spying?
Well, it's beyond me. I never knew that you could use counterintelligence capabilities. These are the capabilities that we have in our government to go after and target terrorists. I never knew that you could actually go out and use those capabilities to spy on Americans. And look, we don't know all this yet for sure, but I think we have strong suspicions that is exactly what was happening. And you really only have to look at the text messages from Strzok and Page, who were the FBI agents who were the lead that ultimately served on the Mueller dossier team.
Mm.
They were texting about this stuff.
They wanted an insurance policy.
That's right.
Congressman, it's good to see you this morning.
That's right.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Maria.
We continue to peel back the onion on this blowout story, which, of course, we've been covering now for 2 years, and you've heard the truth right here.
Coming up next is Hillary's BS, bull manure or whatever, you know, that word is, starting with an H. But she's been going on a lot of talk shows and being interviewed and continuing to hit the Russian angle. But here we go now, and these are just outright fabrications at this point. Here we go with Hillary.
As I've been telling candidates who have come to see me, you can run the best campaign, you can even become the nominee, and you can have the election stolen from you.
Ah, my gosh, this is a new one. It was just stolen, right? I mean, how exactly was it stolen, Hillary Clinton? Did they break into the Diebold voting machines and actually change things entirely? I mean, keep in mind, she ran, what do you call it, a perfect campaign? Completely ignoring key states like Michigan and Pennsylvania, important political states. She doesn't get it. But you know what? I guess it doesn't matter because she's selling something else entirely. Not that anybody's buying because no tickets are being sold at regular prices. They've been slashing them. This is the Evening with the Clintons worldwide tour, or U.S. tour, I guess, that they're doing. Sales are plunging. Prices are dropping very quickly. There are some reports of tickets going for as little as $2. This is like P.T. Barnum. They're taking the show on the road. The election was stolen. Joining me right now is American Majority CEO Ned Ryan. Ned, I'm curious, is there any precedent for this? Because let me just say, like, I'm going to full out call this just plain old tacky, okay? They're out there trying to sell tickets to Americans. I'm like, you guys don't have enough money? I mean, it's one thing for a president to go and give a speech and talk to a, you know, a certain amount of people, get paid for that in a speech. This is a whole different ballgame. This is vaudeville style. Let's take the show on the road. You know, mom and pop get up there and say that election was stolen. Has any other president done anything like this?
Well, I doubt we've had a president and a spouse as shameful as the Clintons. I call them the grifters.
No, but just a president, like selling tickets.
Right.
You know, speak. $2 a piece now because I can't get the regular going right.
Exactly. At least you would think they'd have some self-awareness how shameful and embarrassing it is that some of those tickets are going for $2. But when I heard that clip, Trish, again, my initial reaction was stolen by whom? Let's name it. If you really think that somehow $300 of Facebook ads in Pennsylvania that were inept or $832 of Facebook ads in Michigan somehow swung a multi-billion dollar campaign, stop. That's not believable. And the fact of the matter is Hillary wants to blame anyone and anything except for the one thing that's truly responsible for her loss in 2016, herself. She was a terrible candidate. She ran a terrible campaign. And guess what? She'll never be president.
It's really amazing. I mean, you got to think of it, the ego, right, of some people to have no self-awareness to know that, you know, you just you're not cut out for it. And by the way, and I say this objectively, her husband was. OK, he was a good politician. He could get up there and play to the crowd in part because he liked the crowd. He liked people and he communicated with them at a level that she just, you know, clearly didn't get. He said, you know, hon, you better go to probably didn't call her hon, but you should go to Pennsylvania. And she opted not to. I mean, what a lousy, lousy politician. And then, by the way, she told all the coal miners that she wanted to put them out of business.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, it was a terrible campaign with a terrible message. I don't think they've really learned their lesson again on identity politics. Again, nobody told them they shouldn't campaign in the Rust Belt. And again, those turned out to be the deciding votes. But the thing that's troubling to me, Trish, in all of this is the fact that you've got Hillary, you've got Stacey Abrams. They're all starting to question the results of these elections. And one of the great aspects of our constitutional republic is the peaceful transfer of power in which one party accepts the fact that they lost an election and they hand over the power of the state to the other party. And what they have been doing, the left was lecturing Donald Trump in 2016 that he had to accept the 2016 results as legitimate. And now for the last 2.5 years, they have been doing anything but accepting the legitimacy of those elections. And that's a troubling fact. Now Democrats
seem to think. She wants to get rid of the Electoral College.
She wants to get rid of the Electoral College.
She wrote a piece on that. And she wants to turn everything upside down so that, I don't know, maybe she can run again. Do you think that in her hearts of hearts is the desire? I mean, why are they doing a vaudeville show selling tickets for $2 a piece? They have enough money, Ned. They really do.
Right.
They have enough money to be out
because
there on tour like this because of the charity, right, where they took money from all kinds of people, including countries that we're not so friendly with.
That's right. No, and the thing that's amazing to me, do this other aspect, again, Hillary just can't accept the fact that she lost. But Democrats now seem to think that something's broken with our democracy when they lose elections, that somehow they're supposed to win every election. Here's a piece of advice to them. Why don't you lose with dignity and accept the fact that people like a really good economy, they like their jobs, they like wages going up, all these ideas and things that Donald Trump and Republicans have put in place, and perhaps they should use some common sense and look at those results and go, maybe it's not them, maybe it's us, maybe we're doing something wrong, but I think they lack complete self-awareness from Hillary to the rest of the Democrats.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, I mean, we heard Robin Biro, who is a Democratic strategist, who worked for Obama, on his campaign, even he's saying, yeah, they need to lose this whole idea of impeachment because it's sending them down the wrong path. And now going after AG Barr, I'll tell you what path, though, it's going to send all of us down as a nation, and it should. It's going to send us down the path of figuring out how the heck this all went down and how the heck we using opposition research that had never been vetted by our own FBI, nor
partisan
even told
propaganda.
To the judge it was opposition research, to get a FISA warrant.
Yep. That's right. No, I mean, and I would argue, Trish, it was partisan propaganda. This was paid for by the DNC. It was paid for by Hillary. It is a crime to falsify FISA applications, and someone, through willful omission, did not tell the FISC that they are using partisan propaganda as evidence for these applications, not once or twice, multiple times. Again, it was four times. It was once and then renewed three times. And I think we've got to get to the bottom of this. This is deeply troubling. The rule of law, people using the surveillance state and law enforcement as political weapons against political opponents. And the reason that they're so scared of AG Barr, Trish, because they're afraid of where this will go. I think it will go to the Obama West Wing. I think it will go to the top of our intelligence communities, and I think it will go to the top of our law enforcement. Oh. And I think there has to be a reckoning. People have to go to jail for what they did.
You see, there's a lot of reasons for a special counsel. Now, Mark Levin states specifically and very eloquently the reasons for a special counsel to be appointed to uncover all this FISA abuse and so forth. But here we go with Mark Levin.
All right, joining us now with reaction to all of this, author of Unfreedom of the Press, which is coming out very soon. He hosts Life, Liberty, and Levin right here on the Fox News Channel, host of Levin TV, nationally syndicated radio. I call him the great one, Mark Levin. Mark, you used to be you worked for Ed Meese. You were his chief of staff. Okay, you talked at length about longstanding policy about indicting a sitting president. Barr said it had nothing to do with it. Barr said Mueller had no consideration to do with it.
Right.
So Comey, who we now know the FBI was informed fully about the dirty dossier, he signed the first FISA warrant. To me, he's the one in legal jeopardy, ironically, and not the president.
All right. What ought to happen here is there ought to be a grand jury impaneled. Comey should give testimony. McCabe should give testimony. Baker should give testimony. Stroke, Page. The whole cabal should be giving testimony. They should get a little bit of their own medicine. We should have a criminal grand jury, and we should have either a special counsel or a United States attorney take charge of this case and get to the bottom of it, put these people under oath, and let them get the Donald Trump treatment. We want all their documents, no privileges, nothing. Drag them in, and maybe drag their kids in, too. But I wanted to talk about something else, because Nancy Pelosi is quite ubiquitous these days. She's barely coherent. She is a constitutional illiterate, but that's the person they chose as Speaker of the House. And I got to thinking, she's very, very rich. She's a multimillionaire. I don't really care about that. She has a husband people don't even know. His name is Paul Pelosi. He's a San Francisco real estate developer. He's a financial investor. Tell me, how did the Pelosis make their money? Tell me, who do they know? Are there any foreign interests? Have we seen their bank accounts? Have we seen their tax returns? I'm curious, because Nancy Pelosi, like Eva Peron today, she announced that we make the laws in the House of Representatives, and I need to remind the Speaker of the House, actually you don't. You pass bills, and they're not laws until they go through the Senate, and the President signs them. That's how the system works. But I'd like to know about all their connections, how they got so rich. I really would. What we have here is an attack on the president, an attack on his family. Collusion, special counsel, contempt, obstruction, constitutional crisis. I just started writing them down. Impeachment, tax returns, bank accounts they want. They've already leaked some of his tax information. They accuse him of campaign violations. They accuse him of being a racist, an anti-Semite, mentally unfit for office. Let me tell you what's going on here. The Democrat Party has hijacked the House of Representatives. This is an opposition research campaign. They're working for whomever the Democrat nominee is. If they can impeach the president, they'll impeach the president. What they're trying to do is drive down his ratings to get him under 30%, and then they'll go for impeachment. Otherwise, they'll act like he should be impeached. They'll talk about a constitutional crisis. These are the talking points now. They create the conflicts. They create the issues. They create the confrontation. They issue scores and scores of subpoenas. Six committees, the committee chairman, as I speak, are meeting in dark in some shadowy room, trying to figure out how to bring down the President of the United States, how to embarrass him. They go after his businesses. They go after his son. They go after his associates. They go after his counsel. They go after him. What is the purpose of all this? Oh, well, we want to know if the IRS is working. Let me tell you a secret. The IRS isn't working. It never works. So that's not an issue. Well, we want to make sure there isn't any foreign collusion. Great. Then all you members of the House and Senate, you cough up your tax returns and your bank accounts so we can make sure you're not in the back pocket of some third world country. Well, we just want to make sure our financial system works. Well, let me tell you something. It works. You don't work. The debt is through the roof. Everybody can see through this. And it's not just the federal Democrats. Maryland and D.C., the Democrats get together there. They bring a phony lawsuit. The emoluments clause, because the president has a hotel and foreigners stay there, so he must be making money on the side. Such BS. New York, state tax returns. We're going to pass a bill of attainder, which is federally unconstitutional. What is that? A law aimed at one citizen, the president. We're going to turn his state tax returns over to Congress. Let me tell you what's going on. This is a Democrat Party cabal trying to reverse the 2016 election, trying to disenfranchise 63 million voters, mostly Republicans, independents, and some Democrats, led by a Speaker of the House from San Francisco, a chairman of the House Judiciary Committee from New York, the chairman of the Oversight Committee from Baltimore. Three or four blue cities trying to change the course of this country, trying to reverse the course of the election. And let me tell you, they keep saying the American people want. They don't represent the American people. They keep saying they're following the Constitution. They're shredding the Constitution. They don't even know what's in the Constitution. It is we who are standing up to this cabal, this rogue activity. It is we who are standing up for the Constitution. And let me tell you something,
Mark.
They are playing with political fire. There are tens of millions of people who are not going to stand for this. And they are going to vote. They're going to become more active than ever before. And they are going to not only lose the presidency, they will lose the House. We will strengthen the Senate. And then maybe we'll subpoena the hell out of them. And then maybe we'll have special counsels against them. Because if they want to use Soviet tactics against Republicans, then the only way the Democrats know to stop is if Soviet tactics are used against them. That's it.
When's the book out?
The book comes out May 21. People can pre-order it on Amazon.com or any of those sites and so forth.
Vanity.com,
I think it's
too.
It's a very, very important book.
I get the first
book.
Interview for that book. We have it arranged already, but we'll make the announcement at the appropriate time. Great one. That's why we
Look
call you the great one.
Mark Levin is hard-hitting, conservative, constitutionalist right down the middle. I mean, not down the right, I should say, but he's fair. But he describes the Constitution and this government system and checks and balances like anyone should. Bongino, we're going to get a little bit of a summary for the week from Bongino. Here we go with Bongino.
It's Friday. Naturally, things are blowing up, especially Dan Bongino's news explosion, our former favorite former Secret Service agent, New York City cop, here to rank the top three stories of the past week. Dan Bongino joins us tonight. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Tucker, how are you? I'm always happy to be here. This is my favorite segment of the week, so let's get right to it. Most explosive story of the week, numero tres, number three, Joe Biden discovers the money fairy and wants to give health care to people in the country illegally. Tucker, have you heard this one? This one's fascinating. Yeah, so, Tucker, when you factor out the United States, the world has 7 billion people. Of course, there's no rate-limiting factor to providing health care for everyone. So how we're going to afford that, I have no idea. But don't worry, Tucker. Joe Biden will figure it out in conjunction with the money fairy. He's got this.
Well, I don't know. Can't wait to see the money fairy.
Hey, crazy how that happens. All right, explosive story number two of the week. China gets a taste of its own medicine. President Trump hammers China back with 25% tariffs. You know, Tucker, I am a free trader. I know you probably are too, but China's not trading fairly. You know, we thought when they joined the WTO, they would handle themselves a little differently, more prosperity, more freedom. That's not what happened. It's become the world's largest surveillance state. And, you know, in my opinion, I'm a free trader again, but good for President Trump for fighting back. This is a very important story.
Do that.
All right. This is big. This is the gold medal of stories this week. I have to spend a little time on this one. This is critical. Jerry Nadler Jerry Nadler, who's competing with Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell for who can be the biggest hack in Congress right now, Jerry Nadler is filing contempt charges against Attorney General Bill Barr for not producing a report, Tucker, that you and I can get on our iPhones right now. You can actually go to, did you know this, Tucker? You could go, this may be breaking news. You can, and you're laughing, but you can go to Amazon right now or Barnes & Noble or whatever you want to do and actually pick up a copy of the Mueller report that Jerry Nadler wants to file criminal charges against Bill Barr for not producing. You know, are we living in peak stupid? Or are me and you crazy, or are we living in, like, peak stupid right now? You realize, too, that the one piece of the redaction Jerry Nadler wants that Bill Barr cannot produce because it's Congress's own law, Rule 6E, do you find that a little confusing, Tucker? Like, you can buy the Mueller report he's saying he can't get, and then the redactions he wants he can't get because Congress created this law, Federal Rule 6E. Again, we are living in the dumbest of times. I'm really sorry to have to do that to your audience. It reminds me of Billy Madison. You remember that scene in Billy Madison? We're all dumber for having heard that right now.
And degrading, too. Hating this much diminishes people, and they have been diminished. I mean, I think Jerry Nadler was never that impressive, but he wasn't like a full-on buffoon as he is today. Embarrassing.
Yeah. No.
Dan Bongino.
Doesn't it make you feel bad that these people are in power? I mean, really. It's really pathetic.
I wouldn't want them to have any more power. They make me very nervous, taking
God
my guns
forbid.
Away, et cetera. Dan Bongino, have the best weekend. Thank you for that explosion.
You too, buddy. See you next week.
We're going to replay a Glenn Beck presentation on Apollo Alliance. And this is Van Jones's, you could say, organizations to a large extent, that he's been networking with to establish a really leftist type of run around the end, you know what I mean, to the end zone for a big touchdown. But anyway, Van Jones has been manipulating and controlling and dominating some of these organizations for years, and Glenn Beck exposed him, so here we go.
You know, what we're uncovering here on this program is complex. And it takes a lot of our day just to figure out how to explain this to you. And it's complex by design. You know, it's the vast left-wing conspiracy. The Apollo Alliance combines environmental policy, the green movement, with labor and social justice. Why is that troubling? Maybe it's the guy behind the curtain making it all happen. He's a former black nationalist and self-professed communist. Here is Phil Kirpin. He is the director for policy for Americans for Prosperity. Phil, how are you, sir?
I'm good, Glenn. How are you?
Good. Tell me a little bit about Apollo and these. I have Acorn and the Black Farmers and the Sierra Club and Greenpeace and AFL-CIO and SEIU. Why are these three categories, how are they tied to Apollo?
Well, the Apollo Alliance is designed to bring together the elements of organized labor with the community organizers, with the green groups, the environmental groups, and to access all of the big foundation money that's been supportive of those causes in the past. So it's kind of Van Jones, who you mentioned, the self-described communist who's now green jobs czar, he described the Apollo Alliance mission as sort of a grand unified field theory for progressive left causes. It ties all these things together.
And Apollo is named Apollo. Do you know why it's named Apollo?
Yeah, they really admire the Apollo mission, the moonshot mission, and they think that we need a similar centrally planned, organized, massive mobilization to reorder society and take control of energy and their various other objectives. So they admire that. They want to like moonshot.
Right, and I saw on their website, and I can't remember the exact quote, but it's something like massive and fast. They wanted something like the moonshot that could happen and just be launched quickly. Okay, so Van Jones, he is a self-proclaimed communist. He is one of the founding members of Apollo, right?
That's right, of the National Apollo, yeah.
Okay. And then we have Wade Rathke. Wade Rathke, who is the founder of Acorn, he was on the board of directors, if I'm not mistaken, of the institution that is funding and paying for Apollo, right?
Yeah, he was until this year on the board of the Tides Foundation and of the Tides Center, which are the parent organization that hosts the Apollo Alliance.
Okay, so Wade Rathke, Acorn, Tides Center, they decide that they're going to fund and create Apollo. One of the founders is the guy who went to jail. This is during the Rodney King thing. He went to jail, and he was just a black nationalist. He came out a communist, and he also then started looking into the Green Movement, and he's the guy who said, hey, if we tie labor and Acorn and the Greenpeace together, we've got a super powerful group, Apollo. Is it true Apollo helped design the stimulus package?
They did. They put out a draft stimulus bill last year in 2008. It included almost everything that ended up being in the final stimulus bill. Harry Reid has thanked them for helping design the final stimulus package that was enacted into law. And they brag on their website that they helped design this thing and push it through.
Okay. SEIU, this is the labor group that they're the ones pushing through health care. This is Acorn / SEIU. Their vice president is on the board of directors of Apollo, correct?
Yeah, Gerlin Hudson, the vice president of the SEIU, is on the Apollo board of directors.
Okay. Can you tell me where John Podesta fits into all of this?
John Podesta is also on the Apollo board. He, of course, is also the president of the Center for American Progress, which sends out the daily marching orders, the talking points for the left side of the blogs and the online activists and those organizers out in the street, the Acorn and the SEIU folks. They get their daily talking points from that Center for American Progress email.
Okay. America, I'd just like to ask you, Barack Obama keeps trying to separate himself from all of these organizations. He's telling us, he's giving speeches, and he's telling, I'm one of you guys, I really am one of you. But then, these organizations, he'll always distance himself over and over and over again from the individuals. But let me ask you this, John Podesta, Van Jones, who is now his green job czar, an avowed communist, we've got the SEIU, who's in his office once a week talking about labor. They're the ones that were negotiating with all of the healthcare industry. He's in Obama's office all the time. Wade Rathke, former founder of Acorn. It all ties to the Tide Center, but who's really at the top of all of this? Who's the one that's trying to stay away from all of it and saying, I have nothing to do with it? Obama. But if you look at what Apollo, social, see if these sound familiar, like maybe, I don't know, the way we're going to transform America. Social justice, the Green Movement, and labor unions. Maybe it's just me, Phil. Can you talk me out of the crazy tree here and saying this is exactly what Barack Obama stands for, and these are his soldiers?
Well, look, there are a lot of connections here that make it look like that's certainly the case. Of course, we've got John Holdren, the science czar, who's also tied up with a lot of these folks. We've got Jason Grummet, who was the chief advisor for energy on the Obama campaign, who's also on the board of John Holdren's group, the National Energy Commission, which is also tied in with these folks. I think that if you look at Obama's past, he was an organizer for Acorn. He was actually their chief national trainer. You look at all of the organizations that are actually doing the footwork to push through all the elements of the Obama agenda, and it's pretty clear that he's part and parcel of these radical movements. He really can't separate himself from them, in my view.
I don't know how you can put self-acclaimed communist as a czar and claim that you're not part of that. I don't know how you can surround yourself with radicals and say that you have nothing to do with that. This man is a radical. Please talk me out of the crazy tree, America. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. You know, I tell you, it is, it's this kind of stuff is the reason why Common Sense has now been the number one book in America on both USA Today and New York Times in all categories, all genres. It is a bestseller now for, I think, 5 weeks in a row. And the reason.
Next, we have Ingram, Laura Ingram, with Chris Hughes, who is one of the founders of Facebook. And he's going to tell the reason why Facebook should be closed down or are regulated under antitrust types of angles, it sounds like to me. Here we go with Ingram and Hughes.
But in a much ballyhooed New York Times op-ed, former Facebook co-founder Chris Hughes called for the breakup of the company he built with his buddy Mark Zuckerberg during their Harvard days. Now, his piece got him booked far and wide across the media landscape.
This is a monopoly. A market is frozen. There is no competition. And there's no accountability. The time is up. There have been too many scandals. There have been too many problems. It's up to government to come in, break up the company, and set this baseline of standards.
Okay, who is Chris Hughes? He was the Harvard classmate of Zuckerberg, where, of course, they founded the social media giant Facebook. Now, he left the company over a decade ago with a small, very lucrative stake valued at roughly $850 million. That's about 1% of the company. Well, after he cashed out, though, Hughes volunteered for Barack Obama's 2008 presidential campaign. And then he used his newfound wealth to buy the notorious liberal New Republic magazine, inserting himself as editor. Tried to rehab that, revive that. Well, didn't work. Ended up selling that off a couple years later. Recent years, he's become a proponent of universal basic income. Well, it's only when you know all of those liberal bona fides that Hughes has that you start to understand the real thinking behind his call to break up the social media giant. His main gripe is this, quote, "I'm disappointed in myself and early Facebook team for not thinking more about how the news feed algorithm could change our culture, influence elections, and, this is my favorite, empower nationalist leaders." Trump. Well, there it is. My guess is that if Hughes thought Facebook was amplifying the right voices, meaning the left voices, then there wouldn't be the need for this correction. Now, look, there are plenty of issues with Facebook. Privacy, monopoly power, et cetera, all of which we've documented on this show. But to suggest that the movements around the globe and Europe and beyond, things like Brexit, the rise of Trump's economic policies, they're only popular because of Facebook, it's just ludicrous, completely missing the point. And at bottom, I think this is typical leftist snobbery. We don't like your ideas, so they can't be organic. It's kind of like the way they treated the Tea Party back in 2010. They called it all AstroTurf. It didn't matter. Well, the same thing happened with Trump's election. Disillusioned elites were so shocked that they had to create another reason for their loss. And in the end, well, the breakup of Facebook, you know, might even be a good idea, but the reasons they're putting forth aren't that convincing. So with the emergence of these social media companies as the main vehicle for disseminating free thought, to break them up on these grounds could actually have a chilling effect on speech that some of the former leaders or even current leaders of Facebook don't like.
Coming up next is a pro-life activist, and she's reporting on Tucker Carlson's program on violence against pro-life individuals and activists. Here we go now with this report.
Well, as you just heard, hateful attacks in the pro-life movement are now normal. We just heard about what happened in downtown Philadelphia with Pennsylvania Representative Brian Sims. Here's part of it.
Hi, everyone. Representative Brian Sims here, and I am outside the Planned Parenthood.
A bunch of pseudo-Christian protesters who've been out here shaming young girls for being here.
Hi.
And so here's the deal. I've got $100 to anybody who will identify any of these three.
So we're
going to donate to Planned Parenthood.
I'm
going to donate to Planned Parenthood. So look, a bunch of white people standing up in front of a Planned Parenthood shaming people. There's nothing Christian about what you're doing.
Well, today, pro-life activists held a large-scale rally outside that same Planned Parenthood in Philadelphia in response to Sims' behavior. Abby Johnson is a former Planned Parenthood clinic director, now a pro-life activist. Her story was told in the recent film Unplanned. Abby Johnson joins us today. Abby, thanks very much for coming on. So is it
of course
our imagination, or is the reaction to anti-abortion activism, including prayer, turning violent?
It is. It's becoming increasingly violent, and I think one of the reasons is because people in their own party, the Democratic Party, are not willing to come out and talk about this behavior, condemn this behavior. Nobody from the National Organization for Women, who are supposed to stand up for women, nobody's coming out and condemning this behavior. And so it just sort of goes unchecked, and it goes unnoticed and without consequences. And you know, I'm here to say, along with 1,000 other pro-lifers who were there today, to say this is enough. We've had enough. We're not going to be bullied. We're not going to be harassed. We're out there. This is within our First Amendment right to do so.
What do you think is driving this? These are people who are arguing for abortion, in some cases, post-viability late-term abortion. Not only they're not ashamed of that position, but they want to hurt anyone who disagrees. Why do you think, where does that come from, that impulse?
Well, so I think it's a couple things. I think right now, abortion supporters are, they're feeling the heat. They're feeling the pressure. We've got these heartbeat bills being signed all across the country. We have pro-life measures taking place in many, many different states. I think that now we have a Supreme Court that's being set up to overturn Roe v. Wade. So I think in some ways, it's a response to the sort of impending doom that they feel that Roe might one day actually be overturned. But I think also, you know, we've got over 60 million abortions on the books recorded since Roe was passed in 1973. And, you know, we're dealing with a group of people who are very wounded. They're very hurt. Yeah. And they need to really justify their own actions. And a lot of times that hurt comes across as anger, and they just don't see the difference.
I think that's exactly right. When you know you're wrong, that's when you're the maddest. That's how I am. I think mm-hmm. that's how most people are. It's sad. Abby, thank you very much.
Of course. Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week. And I want to say make a few comments about a couple of things that I studied back in all the late 80s and the early 90s, I would say. And one of the studies that I made was Monarch programming. And this is based upon using MPD, multiple personality disorder, and then taking and torturing people while you're beginning the programming of inducing into them or creating from that torture session and so forth, a multiple personality, an altar. Is what they would be saying. And also satanic ritual programming is closely aligned with this. There was a couple of books out that I would recommend, and one would be Transformation of America by Kathy O'Brien. And then there's an author of many good articles and comments on this by the name of Kathleen Sullivan. She was a victim of this type of programming. And this programming has come out of a very deep state here, and it's very sinister and very evil, and it's very involved, and we just must take note at times like we're in now as to the effect that this is having against the effect it's having to about America, against America, and it's creating a cadre of people. Another thing would be like programmed or targeted individuals. And I've read extensively back in that era a few decades ago about psychotronic devices and so forth. I think Deborah Tavares has gotten into these soft weapons before. She's someone to read on the internet also. And she knows about there's just a comprehensive programming system here on different levels. And it has been destructive for our country. And it's continuing, I should say. So it's causing a very, very destructive mechanism in the country. I want to thank everyone for listening tonight. And especially those people that are dedicated to trying to reorder and rewrite this capsized boat called America, and to try to do something different. I do have a little aphorism that I created this evening talking to a friend of mine way out in Nevada, but we went back and forth, and here's the little aphorism. Lightning bugs bring us nature's light from out of the darkness. Let me say that again. Lightning bugs bring us natural light from out of the darkness. The natural law is all important. We've got to get back to teaching it in our schools. But thank you for listening this evening, and good night.